Hello, everybody, and welcome to New Books in History. My name is Marshall Poe. I'm your host. Every week, we pick a new history book, and we interview the author of that book. These are books that we find particularly interesting, and we hope that you'll find them interesting as well. This week on the show, we have J.D. Bowers. He teaches at Northern Illinois University, and he has a recent book out called Joseph Priestley and English Unitarianism in America. I very much enjoyed my talk with Professor Bowers, and I hope that you'll enjoy it as well. Here's the interview. Hi, J.D.
Hi, Marshall.
How are you today?
I'm doing well, thank you.
That's very good. Today we have J.D. Bowers on the show, and we'll be talking about his book, Joseph Priestley and English Unitarianism in America. J.D. teaches at Northern Illinois University. Actually, I think I have friends there, J.D. It's been a while since I've talked to them, but it's a very large department, isn't it?
Yes, we have about 32 faculty.
You got bunches of people. That's more than we have here at Iowa. So I suspect we probably shouldn't have, like, a basketball game or something. We'd probably lose, although I play basketball, so we might be good. Anyway, why don't you begin by telling us a little bit about yourself, where you grew up, and where you went to school, and so on and so forth, how you got into history, that kind of thing.
Okay. I grew up in Northumberland, Pennsylvania, which actually is where Joseph Priestley settled when he came
right.
to America.
It's in the book. That's interesting.
My parents still live about four blocks from the Priestley house.
Wow.
And the Little League baseball field is actually in what was once Priestley's front lawn that, from the house, you know, the typical English home that he had built, you know, sort of sloped down towards a vista to the river. And when the canals came through in the 1820s and the railroads later, it bisected the yard, and eventually the town acquired the lower half, and it's now the Little League baseball field where
right.
I played Little League.
That's
so
amazing.
And I always kind of liked history growing up because of the Priestley house, and there's Fort Augusta, and there's a lot of Indian heritage and culture around the region, and Gettysburg is within a very quick drive, as well as Philadelphia. And so from an early age, I started getting interested in history, and my parents, when I begged and pleaded them when I was 10, agreed to take me to Williamsburg.
Mm-hmm.
And I fell in love with the place, so much so that 8 years later I applied to go to college at William & Mary.
Is that right?
Yeah, and it was a fabulous decision for me. You got to live in history, you got to work in history, you got to study in history.
Yeah.
I worked for Colonial Williamsburg.
Wow.
I worked for the National Park Service at Yorktown. It was just a kind of a fascinating experience for me.
That's fantastic.
It is. It's sort of why, you know, why Williamsburg is there in many ways. And so it made a lot of sense to me to continue to when I took about 3 years off after my undergraduate years.
Uh-huh.
I needed some time to recuperate.
And who doesn't?
It was pretty punishing in many ways.
Yeah.
And after 3 years in college admissions, which I had decided that pretty much anybody could pass out brochures at a college night.
Yeah.
I decided to go to grad school and went to Indiana and worked. When I was at Indiana, I worked under the late Paul Lucas and Bernard Sheehan and Steve Stein and Bob Orsi. So I crossed between history and religion. And it was Paul Lucas who encouraged me to think about kind of local history and history as something that reaches out to the community, instead of just doing history for history's sake or for other historians and adding something to the historiography. He really encouraged me to think about adding something to a community that I knew about and a community that I was involved in.
A person after my own heart. Because that's it's part of what we're doing here today, I think, on New Books in History.
So. Well, right, and I think it fits really well with sort of my overall philosophy, which, and I've enjoyed the notion of going out and speaking to Unitarian churches and speaking to groups of people. And to me, you know, we can't just, I use the saying that we can't just all sell pizza to each other. We have to start selling pizza to other people outside the pizza community. So,
right.
And some people agree with that and some people don't. And
well, I certainly do, and I congratulate you on your work. I mean, I wrote very obscure books that nobody read about early Russian history for the first part of my career, and then I kind of always knew that nobody was reading them, but it was really brought home to me after I worked in publishing for a little while. And then I decided if I was going to come back to academia that I would try to take a greater role in what is sometimes called, I think, poorly public history. I just call it history.
Right.
And try to get the word out to people about various things. And things like Colonial Williamsburg are obviously terrific in that way. But I think we need a lot more of that kind of thing, particularly, you know, in talking about monographs such as yours or any monograph. There's huge oceans of literature out there that can be read by people, but it just doesn't ever reach them. So,
right, and particularly in religious history. I mean, you know, for a while there, of course, religious history was always kind of denominational and written by the ministers or by a parishioner and almost kind of very hagiographic in a way, you know, celebratory of everything. And then, of course, in the 1960s and 70s, with the critical approaches and things, everything got to be far more abstract and you know, I'm on the Unitarian Universalist listserv, and of course, they don't read academic monographs.
Yeah.
They're not interested in that because it really has moved so far away from what their interests were, and they don't feel that many academic monographs talk about them.
Right.
They can't see themselves in these books.
Yeah.
And so for me, it was kind of a nice way to say, well, let's step back a little bit and let's look at a group of people, you know, as a denomination, and their congregations that are adhering to a set of ideas, and let me talk to the Unitarians again. Let me see if we can engage them in sort of a discussion that brings us halfway. And and I've argued that case that public historians are sort of, we're in the middle if we're in a university, because we're not out there like Williamsburg and where we're dressing up and talking to the people. And we're not the local historians who are just digging through the church archives. We're kind of trying to do something different.
Yeah, and that's a tough thing. I don't think most people realize what a tough thing that is to do in academia, because our metric for success is basically the scholarly monograph.
Right.
And as a junior member of any department, especially one that requires a lot of publication, like I'm sure that Northern Illinois does, it would be not in the best interest of a junior colleague to write a popular history book, I think.
Right.
But then again, this is kind of the paradox of it. Once you have tenure, it really doesn't matter, but we still don't seem to write them. I don't get it.
Right.
I don't really understand this, but we don't seem to write them. So
I mean, your field, of course, Bruce Lincoln was here at
NIU.
Absolutely.
He was a force of nature in terms
of
writing.
Right, and that was his whole goal,
say,
I want to take Russian history to the people.
And he did.
And, 14 books later.
Right, of blessed memory. Yeah, Bruce, absolutely. No, and he should be a model for all of us.
Right.
But, you know, in terms of professional advancement and things like this, it just really isn't, it's not really going to get you anywhere. So I think there's a strong disincentive against doing it. Also, I think a lot of academics look down their nose a little bit at it. I would say that I honestly did before I worked in publishing for a while, and then I realized, you know, that basically this is the way that scholarly communication gets out to the public, and that is through these books. It's through people like Bruce Lincoln and yourself that this actually gets out. You know, it's actually beating the pavement and talking to people about these things. That's where public education, public historical education occurs.
And you know, if all things go according to plan, in 2 months I'll get that final letter that says, congratulations, you're tenured, and so I'll have done it.
All right, then you can write that book.
Right.
Well, good luck with that.
When
that book comes out, we'll interview you about that one as well. Yeah. So when you were done at Indiana, you said, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Where did you go then?
Well, I actually taught for 6 years in private schools secondary schools.
Uh-huh.
Paul Lucas was my dissertation director, and he passed away rather unexpectedly at the age of 54.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, I wasn't sure I wanted to finish, and I kind of, it was a jarring thing to lose your mentor.
Sure,
and
absolutely.
So I took the opportunity to go and teach at a private school in Honolulu.
Mm-hmm.
I was offered a job at a school in Honolulu and a job in Ohio, and I had to weigh my choices very carefully there.
Well,
so,
sure,
and I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it immensely.
I imagine you did.
And I taught there for 3 years, and then I taught for 2 years at an all-girls school outside of Washington, D.C., and I did a year also at a private school in Montevideo, Uruguay.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a really nice life in many ways. I really enjoyed what I was doing. I enjoyed the connection with the life of the students beyond just the classroom and things.
Mm-hmm.
And while I was teaching in Washington, D.C., a colleague, who's now a colleague here at Northern, approached me at one of the OAH conferences and said, we've got this position that's going to be coming open, and, you know, you might be a good candidate for it.
That's
so
terrific.
I was flattered, and I applied and fortunately got the position.
That's fantastic. You know, I just wanted to talk to you for a second about, now this is on a high school level you were teaching, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah, because I have students come to me all the time who say, you know, I don't want to go directly to graduate school. I want to teach in high school for a while and then maybe go back to graduate school.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a career path for people to do that now? Because in my day, I think I'm a little older than you are, that was impossible.
Yeah, I think it is possible. I mean, there's the Madison Fellowship, which, you know, offers high school teachers a chance to come and get a master's.
Uh-huh.
Now that requires some specific track of study, usually government and you know, history of the great presidents and
uh-huh.
things. But there's a lot of people who are doing that. You know, there at the time I was ABD and I wasn't alone being ABD. And
hardly.
There were a lot of PhDs that
yeah.
taught at these schools.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the thing with private schools, though, of course, is they want somebody with at least a master's. So they want
yeah.
somebody who knows their content for sure. And
right.
they'll teach you how to teach.
Right.
And they did a, you know, I think they did a really good job. I appreciated the efforts that they put into helping to craft and shape me as a teacher and really show me a good path.
No, I think you're absolutely right about that. I mean, cutting your teeth on high school students is a terrific preparation. I personally have never taught on the secondary level myself, but my mother was a terrific junior high school teacher her whole life, and I think I got a little bit of it from her. But, you know, we have, you know, when my junior colleagues here, you know, they come from this or that school, you know, a big program like Indiana where they're surrounded by intellectuals and they have great students and they come to a different sort of program and they're thrown into the classroom. It's often the case they're at sea. They don't know
right.
quite what to do. I'm sure that you weren't in that case, having had all that experience on the high school level.
Well, yeah, and you know, I mean, I honor my high school colleagues who teach far more than we do.
Oh, yeah.
I mean,
yeah,
if I was teaching five sections of AP US,
yeah,
that means
I tell you what.
I was running through US history five times a year.
Yeah.
And here at the university, I teach, you know, half of the survey
right.
once every year.
No, no.
So there's a lot more. A lot more chance to improve your teaching and to work on
no,
your
that's
teaching.
Exactly right. You know, it's practice, and practice does make perfect. And I, you know, I just applaud you. That's, I think it's a terrific career story. I just,
thank you.
It's inspirational to me, and I'll have a different thing to say to my students when they come and have decided to go to secondary education and might go on.
Yeah.
So after that, then you got the job at Northern,
mm-hmm.
and you've been teaching there how long?
This is my sixth year, the end of my sixth year.
Mm-hmm. And I take it you're enjoying it there?
I am, very much.
Yeah,
very much.
Like I said, I know some of your colleagues, and they're terrific people.
Yeah, it's been a wonderful challenge, and I've gotten a great deal out of it, and I'm very appreciative for all the opportunities that I've gotten through being here.
Well, that's terrific. And I'm sure the deans are glad to hear that as well.
Yeah.
If they're listening, JD is very happy. So let's talk a little bit about Joseph Priestley. I took a class in college called the Enlightenment. I went to Grinnell College, a little bit
okay.
of college,
mm-hmm.
which I loved, and I had this transformative experience there. And we talked about a guy named Joseph Priestley who invented the theory of phlogiston. Is that
mm-hmm.
right? Is this
yes.
This is the same Joseph Priestley.
Absolutely.
So tell us about the life of Joseph Priestley.
Well, Priestley was born and raised a dissenter in England, and in religious terms, that basically meant that his aunt, Sarah Keeley, who had raised him, was not a member of the Church of England, and so she believed in kind of openness and tolerance and educating her nephew very broadly. And so as Priestley grew up, he was forced, because dissenters could not go to Cambridge or Oxford, he was forced to go to various other colleges that were set up for dissenters, like Daventry Academy.
Mm-hmm.
And
explain just briefly for the audience what a dissenter is.
Anybody who was not a member of the Church of England.
Yeah, well,
you were either in or you're out
uh-huh.
in England. And because if you were not a member of the Church of England, of course, you were also not allowed to hold any political office.
That's
because,
right.
of course, the church and the state were joined.
Yes.
So it actually, and of course, tithing was required in England. And so to be a dissenter really meant one had to stand by one's convictions to say, I don't think the Church of England is right, and I reject the involvement of the state in the church, and I'm going to pay heavily for that in terms of my career opportunities, in terms of my educational opportunities, and if I'm going to support my beliefs through a church, I also still have to support the Church of England.
And this includes both Catholics and Protestant sects.
Oh, this included everybody, yes, absolutely. Catholics, right. Protestants, Unitarians, ultimately, yeah. Presbyterians, mm-hmm. Baptists, Quakers.
Presbyterians,
you know.
I didn't know that. That's interesting. Yeah. Anyway, go on about Priestley. So he's a dissenter.
He's a dissenter, and he's raised in a very, you know, and educated in a very liberal tradition. As you said, he's an Enlightenment figure, so he's raised in an Enlightenment tradition. And so he ends up later in life kind of, he's like Jefferson. He's a master of a lot of things. He really involves himself in a lot of Enlightenment areas. He never considered his science to be his vocation. He always said that the ministry is my vocation, science is my avocation. And so he basically is playing around when he gets the opportunity to play around in experimenting through scientific processes. And so through that, not only does he develop the theory of phlogiston, which of course becomes oxygen, mm-hmm. Under Lavoisier, as he called it. Mm-hmm. Priestley saw it as the absence of something, and Lavoisier said, no, it's the presence of something, yeah. And that's where they differed. But he also invented eight other gases, or not invented, excuse me, he discovered eight other gases, uh-huh. And he invented carbonated water.
Really?
And
he invented carbonated water.
He does. We have Joseph Priestley to thank for Coca-Cola.
That's astounding.
Is you know, my elixir of life. So every day I pretty much think about him.
That's astounding.
He also wrote about Franklin's kite experiment. Many people don't realize that Franklin did not write about that until afterwards. He gave Priestley permission to write about that first in his two-volume History of Electricity.
Wow.
So he really did dabble in these science things, and I think most people, of course, know him as a scientist. But
I confess that I did. I mean,
right, and that's fine. That's perfectly fine. Even when I go to the Priestley house today, I know where the money is, and I know where the bread is buttered. And of course, it's the lab that, you know, that he built in the house that is pristine and well funded and supported. And the kids come to see, you know, a local high school teacher, Ron Blatchley, do the chemical experiments and blow things up. They don't come to talk to me about religion.
Right.
You know, so I know how it all goes.
It's the money's from the NSF, not the NEH.
That's right. That's right.
Don't we know it?
So. You know, so Priestley was really kind of this very interesting character, and friends with just about everybody we know. Friends with Jefferson, friends with Franklin, friends with John Adams. I mean, he was a supporter of the American Revolution. He firmly believed that in the theory of the greatest good for the greatest number. In fact, Bentham sort of paraphrased Priestley in putting that phrase mm-hmm. together. So Priestley was the first one to develop that.
Mm-hmm.
He truly, truly was an Enlightenment figure.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So how does he get us into Unitarianism with Priestley then? Explain, first of all, what Unitarianism is, because I think a lot of people don't know.
Okay.
Although I've had to say, it's one of the most telegraphic names for any denomination I've ever heard.
Yes, that's true. Yeah. That's true. It's meant to be pejorative, of course, like many denominational names originally were. But
uh-huh.
It simply means that there is one God. There is no Trinity. He rejected the notion of God the Father, God the Son, you know, God the Holy Ghost. He held, and other Unitarians held, that Jesus was just a man.
Mm-hmm.
He was a very special prophet. Certainly, he was a prophet appointed by God,
mm-hmm.
but he was not God. And Unitarians went to great lengths to point to verses in the Bible that specifically said, you know, Jesus calls himself a man,
mm-hmm.
and not God.
Mm-hmm.
So, and phrases like Son of God. Yeah. We're supposed to be metaphorical, that we're all sons of God,
mm-hmm.
or you know, daughters of God, if we want to be gender neutral.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Unitarians believe that there was just God, mm-hmm. and they dismissed all these other kind of what they called contrived, you know, nuances and explanations for things in the Bible that they just didn't see fit.
And they did all this on the basis of the investigation of the scriptures themselves, on the
Absolutely.
Basis of scriptural authority.
Priestley read multiple languages, and he would go back to the Greek versions and translate directly from the Greek.
Uh-huh.
So that's where he drew his interpretations from.
Mm-hmm. And explain to us the origins of Unitarianism as it connects with Priestley himself. It must have started out very small.
It did. In fact, I mean, there were a lot of people hanging out within established churches who had always had questions about the Trinity. And they, you know, it took some time to sort of coalesce into a movement. I mean, John Locke, if you read some of his earlier writings on religion, of course, Locke is making or putting forward expressions or statements that many people interpret to mean that he is starting to reject the Trinity, that he mm-hmm. accepts the unity of God. Mm-hmm. And so it you know, takes more than 200 years or so before this, you know, with the influence of the Enlightenment, before this rationalism and this reason and this this way of, you know, very simplistic way of approaching an explanation for God emerges. Mm-hmm. And Priestley himself passed through, as he said and others said, he passed through many other different beliefs before he finally gets to Unitarianism. Mm-hmm. And he actually starts to call his theological belief Socinianism.
Socinianism, yes.
Yeah, it's named after Faustus Socini, who was a thinker out of Poland and had some, you know, pretty basic views on that there is just God and the direction in which the Bible should be interpreted and how we should, you know, think these things through. Mm-hmm. And now Priestley kind of takes that and changes it a little bit, but it becomes known by that name, mm-hmm. Both for negative reasons and positive reasons. And later on, of course, one of the unique thoughts that comes along with Priestley's theology and his belief structure is the idea of soul sleep, which is that when the body dies, the soul remains with the body until mm-hmm. the time of the resurrection. Mm-hmm. Which is very unique. You know, many people often, you know, believe that the death, of course, you know, in emulating what happened to Jesus, the soul rised again, you know, on the third day and mm-hmm. Then went up to heaven and stayed in heaven with mm-hmm. God until the resurrection when everything would happen again.
Pardon me for interrupting, but as an Eastern Europeanist or a Russianist, I'm interested to know, if you know, how Socinianism got to the ears of Joseph Priestley from Poland to England.
But it passed through Poland and into Italy, mm-hmm. where he actually, Faustus and his uncle, were rather well known. Uh-huh. And Priestley's just reading very, very widely.
I see.
There's a group of Transylvania Unitarians uh-huh. as well, and they're sort of the early originators of all of this.
Oh, is that
and
right?
So,
uh-huh.
Yeah, and so if you look in the historiography of Unitarianism, it usually will trace its emergence sort of out of Eastern Europe, Transylvania, uh-huh. then into England, uh-huh. just kind of through the intellectual Enlightenment exchange,
yeah.
uh-huh. And then from England, of course, into the United States.
Uh-huh. Remind me, were there Unitarians in the Radical Reformation? Were there Unitarians in the, that is, by the doctrine, not the name, in the 16th century?
Yes, there were, and they're hiding out.
I imagine they were.
you know, again, they're not people who really want to make a big case out of this, and that's the thing. For a lot of people, Unitarianism was okay to believe, but it wasn't their central belief. And again, we need to separate ourselves from our modern investment in religion in some ways, and where Jesus really is very prominent mm-hmm. in Christianity today. But mm-hmm. there was a time prior to about 1840, 1830 in there where Jesus was not the prominent figure.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when Edwards is talking, when Jonathan Edwards is threatening his congregation, he's threatening them with God, not mm-hmm. Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
And so it wasn't so bad in many ways to believe this, but nobody was going to go out on a limb and say, you know, we're going to be our own denomination.
Right.
We're going to separate from you. A lot right. of people hung out within their congregations and denominations and simply kept the idea, but didn't really say that this is the make or break kind of idea that we have to hold.
I think that's a really interesting point, and it's good for the audience and for me to hear. I mean, the modernity of our kind of civic Christianity, that is mm-hmm. sort of generic Protestant Christianity in the United States, where Jesus is at the center and, you know, personal salvation is, you know, kind of even closer to the center than that. I think it's very interesting to hear that there was a time in which this wasn't the case. I mean, it's kind of analogous to the sense, since Easter is coming up, you know, in the Orthodox calendar, Easter is the big festival. That's one that really matters. Whereas Christmas, which is central to our calendar, is important but was not and still is not terribly important there. I think the varieties of these things and the way they change over time is kind of opaque to people. So it's very good to hear that. So not surprisingly, if I remember correctly, Priestley gets drummed out of England.
Yeah, absolutely. Both for his political views, of course, you know, supporting the American Revolution was not a popular stance.
No.
And ultimately for his religious views. And as he latches on to other like-minded believers, they start, particularly Theophilus Lindsay, they eventually in 1774 start a church in London, and Priestley's traveling there, and they gather a congregation, and it's a fairly large congregation. I mean, the opening ceremony couldn't even be held in the entire chapel.
Huh.
They had people flowing out the windows and all these other things. And so ultimately, of course, he's seen as a threat. He's seen as undermining both the church and the state.
Uh-huh.
And though it's not conducted by official, you know, military men and things, it's encouraged by the crown, by the local sheriff and things, to ransack his home, his lab, oh. his church, and he basically is forced to flee.
This is in what year does this ransacking occur?
1790 is the Church and King riots,
right.
And so then he kind of spends the next 3.5 years or so roaming about, trying to figure out what he's going to do. He petitions the crown for compensation, which is actually, we have a very detailed inventory of what he lost.
So the let me just take a step back. The Act of Toleration of the late 17th century, that just doesn't protect dissenters at all.
No. In fact, Unitarians were excluded from that Act of Toleration.
Oh, yes. Okay.
And of course, it's one thing to put a law on the books, but you know that doesn't mean that the people have to believe it and follow it.
Yeah, no, I can tell you about my the people that live across the street from me who leave trash all over their lawn. nothing I can do. Yeah, anyway, go ahead.
So the citizens and civilians took matters into their own hands.
Right,
and
exactly.
And so, you know, he gets himself set up in a few other positions in England, but really he's faced with a choice of his family is not going to have any prospects. He's three young sons,
right.
all in their late teens, early 20s.
Uh-huh.
He's got a daughter who's fortunately married off to a member of the Church of England, so she's a little protected.
Uh-huh.
But his sons have no prospects, and so it's France or the United States.
Right.
And I think fortunately for him, since of course his fellow scientist Lavoisier lost his head in the French Revolution,
yeah.
Priestley chooses to go off to America
uh-huh.
with some support, with some financial backing from a few people who believe in him and believe his ideas, and with the payment from the crown for the destruction of his goods.
Yeah.
And he, you know, comes to Philadelphia. He lands in New York. He's greeted, you know, the next day by Washington and Adams, and he's kind of celebrated in the press as the venerable Dr. Priestley.
Interesting.
From there, he travels on to Philadelphia, where, you know, Franklin had already died, but Priestley had heard so much from Franklin about Philadelphia that he thinks that that's where he's going to make his home.
Is this kind of a publicity opportunity for the new American government? You know, we've got your great scientist now, and not only that, but we're not going to oppress him for his religion.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't necessarily think that they were using it that cynically. There's William Cobbett, who was better known by the name of Peter Porcupine, was an English immigrant as well, and just went after Priestley. Just said how much of an insult it was that this country would welcome such a person and such a disbeliever.
Uh-huh.
And so I don't think that the government really was given that kind of opportunity, even if they had wanted to use it.
I see. Okay. Okay. So he makes his way to Philadelphia. Philadelphia was quite a place at that time, wasn't
Absolutely.
It? Absolutely. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. I mean, it had a, you know, the college that Franklin started. In fact, they offered Priestley a post there.
Uh-huh.
It was, you know, ready to be the nation's capital.
Uh-huh.
It was everything that I think that a major city could be in
uh-huh.
early America at that
uh-huh.
time. And so Priestley found it to be very cosmopolitan, but he also found it to be very expensive. And, you know, now you're talking about a man who's going to be living on the charity of others, and hopefully be able to get a parish. But how
did he live? I suppose he was just supported by whom?
Yeah, he basically had funds that he could draw from. And in Philadelphia, there were the Vaughan brothers, John and Benjamin Vaughan, and they were once students of Priestley's, and so they were able to give him some financial support as well.
Mm-hmm.
He's also living off of some English funds. France had bestowed some money upon him in an attempt to sway him to move there, as a matter of fact. And Josiah Wedgwood is kind of channeling his English money for him, and Wedgwood, of course, is going to supply him with many of the goods and things that he needs.
Why did the French want him?
Because, again, he would have been a great scientist.
Yeah,
I think the French, actually, you brought up the issue. I think the French, more than the Americans, would have seen this as a public opportunity to say, we can stick it to the British one more way.
Yeah.
And Priestley had traveled on the continent when he was a younger man, and was well liked, and his scientific experiments were so notable that they would have really taken that opportunity.
The French are always looking for an opportunity to stick to the British, aren't they? I mean, that's pretty much their purpose in life, to do that. Again, vice versa. It's incredible. So does he start to build a congregation then in Philadelphia?
He did. There were people who were already sort of looking for a leader. The Vaughan brothers were among many who were already here, who, as English immigrants, as English dissenters, they found the toleration to be legally emboldening for them, although they didn't find it to be so accepting on the practical side. But Priestley's presence had been kind of preceded in the 1780s by one of his followers and protégés, and so his writings and tracts had already been distributed in America. They were already present in many of the libraries. They were already, Americans were aware of who this man was.
Yes.
And his arrival sort of heralds the sounding of, okay, for the English community, particularly in Philadelphia, and for the very liberal community in Philadelphia, here's a man we can rally around. And so by 2 years after his arrival in 1796, he arrived in 94, but in 1796, they already put together a church. They put together a congregation. And Priestley had already made the move to Northumberland, which at that time is about a five-day ride.
Uh-huh.
But he's kind of doing the traditional English thing, and that is he lives in the country where things are cheaper and where he seems, life is a little better. Of course, mm-hmm. Philadelphia was dirty and full of disease, and they certainly had their cholera outbreak in 1793.
Mm-hmm.
But he'll travel to Philadelphia in the summer.
Mm-hmm.
And he eventually signs on with this congregation. But in the meantime, of course, he's also in Northumberland starting a second congregation.
Uh-huh. And why did he pick Northumberland particularly? Is there any sort of discrete reason there? Or
well,
did he just like it?
His sons were going to become American farmers,
kind
of in the Crèvecoeur model, I guess. And there was a tract of land known as the Loyalsock Tract that a bunch of English emigres were looking at coming together and pooling their finances, and they were going to purchase the tract and make a settlement.
Gotcha.
Not quite a utopia, but nonetheless a settlement. And so Northumberland was the closest settled town to the track,
mm-hmm.
and it sits right along right on the confluence of the east and west branches of the Susquehanna.
I see.
It had fairly easy access to Baltimore down the river. Philadelphia, of course, is getting closer at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Northumberland has a postal run already. So there were a lot of reasons to settle there.
Mm-hmm. And it must have been beautiful. It must be beautiful.
It is.
Yeah.
It's still beautiful. You've got the mountains that come right down to the river. You've got these two branches and islands in the middle of the river.
Incredible.
It's a broad river, so it's not very deep
uh-huh.
and easily fordable. And back then, of course, today we do it with bridges. But
we have dirty snow here in Iowa.
Oh, wait, they have dirty snow there, too.
Yeah, this time of year particularly. The snow melts and it uncovers all the sins of the winter.
That's right.
So tell me then, I'm very interested in this question about the American Unitarians. Where do they come from, or where do they claim they come from?
Well, that's one of the two major things that I try to examine in my book, and I respect Conrad Wright, who is, in my opinion, the dean of Unitarian scholarship in this country. Mm-hmm. And Conrad Wright, for many years, has written that the Unitarians in America are indigenous. Mm-hmm. And by that, he means that they came completely out of an American experience, that they were completely shaped by internal aspects and internal developments, and they came out of Congregationalism.
Yep.
Quite honestly, they came out of what was once Jonathan Edwards' church, which
right.
was once the Puritan church.
Right.
Again, it's a lot of people who believe slowly but surely they coalesce these beliefs together that there is just one God, but they have this very real kind of fear that they can't make this the central point because they could be excommunicated. They, in New England, to be driven out of your church was very serious thing.
Mm-hmm.
They're sort of both by choice and by force hiding out, mm-hmm. for lack of a better phrase,
mm-hmm.
Believing this. And eventually they come to call themselves the liberal Christians.
Yes, exactly.
Now, I think it's an important point to make, Marshall, that Priestley and Channing, who we'll probably talk about in a few minutes, but none of these Unitarians, no matter what their unique theological beliefs were, saw themselves as anything but Christians.
Yep.
And people ask me, well, how can Priestley say he's a Christian? Well, he said that Christ was a prophet and a very special prophet, and he lived a life that Priestley emulated. In fact, Priestley celebrated communion because it was the act of the prophet at the Last Supper.
Mm-hmm.
But he was not, you know, he was not the Trinitarian Christian. And I think that we live in an age where we don't often examine that kind of question of who is a Christian, and can you be a Christian and denounce Christ's divinity?
Yeah.
And of course, most people will answer that as absolutely no. But again, this was a different time when
yeah.
people were answering the question very differently, and there wasn't this litmus test necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
So they're all Christians. It's just a matter of, you know, to which they can fight against the establishment.
Uh-huh.
And in New England, that's a very serious thing for them to be doing.
Uh-huh.
So it will take some time. In fact, it's not until 1819 that the New England liberal Christians, those who hold the Unitarian belief, publicly go forward and state that they are Unitarians and that they will call themselves such.
I see.
So you can see the time period at which this is all happening. I mean, the Unitarian idea comes out in easily the 1730s and 40s in
uh-huh.
New England. We start to know that there are people who are professing
uh-huh.
this. But it's going to be, you know, another 80 years before anybody's willing to say, we're our own denomination
right.
now.
So it's underground for a long time. Now, did the American Unitarians then know about the Unitarian Church in England and in Philadelphia and in
yes.
Northumberland?
Yes, everybody did.
Yes.
In fact, one of the arguments that I make is that for a long time, because these liberal Christians are in existence in New England and are staying internal to Congregationalism, that all the known public awareness of Unitarianism falls on the feet of Priestley
yeah.
and his followers and his Socinian theology.
Uh-huh.
If you read any of the religious encyclopedias of the day, and there were numerous works that were trying to sort of, you know, this is the religious landscape of America, and these are the groups we see, and here they are.
Uh-huh.
If you read them, they're all, when it comes to Unitarianism, they're all talking about Priestley.
Really?
They're all talking about the English influence. They're all talking about his Socinian theology.
I see. So how would you characterize the connection between, in terms of influence, between the English utilitarianism of Priestley and the later utilitarianism of the, I guess, Reformed Congregationalists?
Well, it's
this seems to be the nut of the question. Right.
Right.
Here. There, yeah.
It's a tension-filled relationship, of course, because now the New Englanders, because they still have this Unitarian belief, but they have this Congregationalist tradition, they start to create a new theological midpoint and between what Priestley's Unitarianism is and Trinitarianism, and it's known as Arianism.
Yes.
And that is that they believe that Jesus is half man and half divine, that God actually did take Jesus into heaven and bestowed divine status upon him. And I have a wonderful way of showing this in my classroom to my students. I have a picture of Christ that actually comes from the Eastern Orthodox Church because I love the iconography of the Eastern
mm-hmm.
Orthodox Church. And so here's this image of Jesus and surrounded by gold and the halo and everything else. And that, to me, represents the fullness of Christ's divinity. And then I split it in half and only show half of it, and I said, well, that's the Arians.
Mm-hmm.
They believe that Jesus was half there and half not.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's blank, the box is blank for Priestley, who says, no, he's just a mere man.
Mm-hmm.
So you really get this kind of tension-filled relationship between the two groups. And there's always been religious arguing. There's always been, you know, religious infighting and backbiting and,
mm-hmm.
and backstabbing and attempts to denounce those who believe differently than you.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's happening in the early Republic. And there are many, many Trinitarians who are trying to not only attack Priestley, but then attach Priestley's ideas to those liberal Christians in New England.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the liberal Christians don't want that, because they know that that's very dangerous ground, that Priestley was very, very courageous for being so public with his ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And look what happened to him in England, that they really feared that something similar could happen to them. And so they are honestly going to spend the next 30 years really trying to separate themselves and distance themselves from
mm-hmm.
Priestley and the English Unitarians, and they're ultimately going to win.
Now, do you think they do this for political reasons then? In other words, they're trying to accommodate the Trinitarians so that they can kind of find a modus vivendi in Boston and
Absolutely.
Distance themselves? Yeah, uh-huh.
Absolutely. In 1805, excuse me, they went so far as to, they got into a dispute over who could name the person who would hold the chair of theology at Harvard, and it leads to this long dispute that goes to the courts, and the Unitarians actually can then walk away with church property, and they get the right to appoint the Harvard professorship.
I see.
So there's a lot of political...
There's a lot at stake here.
Yes, absolutely,
yeah.
Absolutely. And so to be branded, though, as these non-Christians, as these radical Socinians, just for many New Englanders, was just untenable,
uh-huh.
and they just couldn't allow that.
So the American Unitarians then needed to construct a usable past, as we say.
Yes.
And who was in charge of that?
Well, ultimately, it becomes William Ellery Channing. He
uh-huh.
seizes the mantle. He's the one who steps forward at the ordination of a Socinian minister, might I add, in Baltimore, which had been sort of under the influence of the English Unitarians. He steps forward and says, we are the Unitarian Christians, we hold the mantle, we hold the power, and this is what Unitarianism is.
Uh-huh.
And Channing was a pretty reputable minister. I mean, and for him to go into sort of the, you know, not the home of the enemy, that's a little too strong, but to go into a place where a Socinian had worked and was being ordained, and
uh-huh.
somebody who had affections for Priestley, Jared Sparks, and do that really kind of took everybody by surprise and claimed the ground, so that almost overnight you can see the public's perception of Unitarianism shifting, and Channing and his followers do a really good job at convincing the public that Priestley was nothing but an interloper.
So prior to Channing speaking out in this way, had the English Unitarians and the American Unitarians considered themselves part of one faith?
No. Uh-huh. No, they're really trying to avoid that.
Yeah.
They're really, I mean, the English, yes. I will be frank. I mean, the English Unitarians,
yeah.
Yes. They keep, I mean, you know, they keep calling, even from England, Thomas Belsham keeps reminding the Americans that you're with us.
Uh-huh.
Americans are
saying, no, we're not.
Right, absolutely. And so it's, you know, it's all this kind of perspective thing that, you know, reminds me, you know, the old joke that, you know, boyfriend-girlfriend break up, the boyfriend says okay, the girlfriend says no.
Yeah.
You know, are
right.
we broken up? If
yeah,
she,
right.
if,
yeah,
if exactly. one of them says no.
Right.
And one of them saying no and the other saying yes.
Yeah.
And the Trinitarians are only too happy to take the answers that they want to hear,
mm-hmm.
Anything that weakens the opposition. So they're going to latch on to the English side of that and use that as any means necessary to attack them.
So do they succeed in erasing this early connection between English Unitarianism and American Unitarianism?
Well, in the facts...
Until you, of course.
Yes. Well, they do in many ways. I've never said anything different. The fact of the matter is Priestley and his followers maybe had 30 congregations total.
Uh-huh.
This is not a prominent idea in America even today. I mean,
uh-huh.
if you get on to get into the census figures and look at the number of Unitarians. They're under 1% of the American population.
Uh-huh.
It's never been a major, major idea in America. And
uh-huh.
And so for Priestley and his followers, they weren't extremely numerous either. And the fact that Boston, and it becomes known as Channing and Boston and kind of the center of this new thought,
uh-huh.
That they're far more numerous. They take far more churches with them when they take their split.
Mm-hmm.
They're pretty successful in attempting to claim the ground. And I don't want to say that they go to the extent of trying to completely erase Priestley's legacy,
mm-hmm.
but they're pretty good at saying and getting their own believers around to the point where they don't talk about it for about 20 years.
Really? That's funny. And
yeah, I take the Will James, you know, in his Varieties of Religious Experience, he talks about this. He talks about how, you know, that there are always denominational infighting,
mm-hmm.
And that those who win then seek to actively erase the losers because they don't want theology to ever be seen as changeable, as malleable.
Sure.
So they have to expend a lot of energy doing that. And,
sure.
And I see that verbatim mm-hmm. replicated in what the Unitarians were going through during this time period.
Mm-hmm. I see what you mean. Now, was there anyone prior to yourself who was as impolitic enough to bring up this rather, I guess from their perspective, disturbing legacy?
Well, modern Unitarians don't seem to have a problem with it.
Uh-huh.
I mean, you go into a Unitarian church and you'll find just about anybody from everywhere.
Uh-huh.
You know, Unitarians who were born Unitarians, Unitarians who were converted from something else.
Uh-huh.
They see the variety in their own church today, and for them it makes sense to look back and see this plurality, this diversity, this variety.
Uh-huh.
Andrew McCulley has written a really nice book on Unitarianism in the South, and I'm looking for it on
yeah.
myself as we speak, one of those things, you know. It's called Unitarianism in the Antebellum South,
uh-huh.
The Other Invisible Institution. And so his subtitle, I think, is great because, you know, again, it talks to the way in which Unitarianism was often not very visible, not very numerous, not very large, but it's still there and it enjoys prominence among a lot of the intellectuals.
Mm-hmm.
So he did a really nice job in his book of exploring sort of the Scottish connection and how that flowed into the Scots who came into the South. And in fact, a Scotman by the name of William Christie is a follower of Priestley, and he comes over and takes over Priestley's church in Northumberland when Priestley mm-hmm. dies. And so there's he offered that up maybe about 4 years before my book came out.
Mm-hmm.
And he was really helpful in giving me some encouragement and pointing me in various ways to look at.
Yeah.
But I'm pretty much in opposition right now to the, you know, Conrad Wright's work and
yeah.
and the others who have followed.
Mm-hmm.
We'll see. I'm giving the annual address at the Unitarian Universalist Historical Society on April 11th.
Oh, that'll be fun.
And I guess Conrad is going to be the commentator.
That'll be fun.
So it'll be, you know.
I consider it to be a great blessing to have somebody in your field who you disagree with and are collegial with. That
right.
makes things a lot better. Because I know
and
that. Go ahead. Oh,
he's been wonderful.
I'm sure he
wrote me letters. He supported
That's
me
great.
And encouraged me. He gave me a lot of different ways of thinking about and looking at this. So it was nothing but a positive.
It's
been nothing but a positive relationship.
That's really terrific. So as a kind of closer, tell me a little bit about. Unitarianism in England and the United States today.
Well,
are there still Priestleyites in? I just made up that term in England.
The English development goes a little bit differently. Robert Asplund sort of takes control, and ironically, I should say that both the English and the Americans formalize their Unitarian structures on the same day in 1825.
Oh, really?
But they don't, of course, you know. There was no internet, so they didn't
yeah,
know.
Right.
But, yeah, it takes months before they figure
yeah.
it out. They continue to prosper. They, you know, the Socinian idea, if we're going to say that it's the mere idea that Jesus was mere man, yes, Priestley wins. Channing and the Arians lose.
Uh-huh.
Unitarians today just believe that there is a God.
Uh-huh.
They don't believe that Jesus was anything more than a prophet.
Mm-hmm.
So, but nobody's sitting around cheering that kind of victory.
Right.
That's not their style and their take on it all.
Right.
But they continue to I wouldn't say thrive, but they continue to exist. They continue to do well. In 1960, Unitarians were I think on both sides, many people felt they were begrudgingly in a position where they had to merge with Universalism,
mm-hmm.
in order to sustain themselves in the United States.
Uh-huh.
Unitarianism still exists solely in England,
uh-huh.
as its own group,
uh-huh.
Both kind of continue on in this vein of saying we're the ones who have the rational thought that this 3-in-1 mathematical formula doesn't work.
Right, exactly.
It's interesting. I go into Unitarian churches a lot these days, and I really find that the congregation really is reflected in its minister. And so there are Unitarian Christians, but there are Unitarian liberals who,
uh-huh.
who just absolutely denounce even God.
Huh.
And so 2003, William Sinkford, the president of the UU Association, dared to step forward and say, maybe we need to bring God back into the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And what an uproar.
Yeah, really? That didn't go very well?
No, they're still seething about it.
Oh, really? Oh, my.
3 years later, the conversation is still over whether or not that's even appropriate to raise that.
Wow.
So it's a very interesting division. And there's actually a group now in the United States that's going back to Priestley's ideas.
Oh, really?
And yes, and they're claiming the old name, and they're claiming that we need to be Christians. And there's even a man by the name of Anthony Buzzard at Atlanta Bible College who is a conservative Unitarian theologian.
Wow.
So, the diversity and the complexity of Unitarianism continues.
That is so interesting. So why don't you tell us what you're working on now and what your next project is, if you have one?
I do. I'm going to step away from Unitarianism for a little bit, although I do want to work as one of my next two or three projects. I do want to work on a modern history of Unitarianism,
uh-huh.
kind of tracking these changes that I was just talking about since the 1920s.
Uh-huh.
But my next upcoming project is going to be on the role of religion in the American public sphere,
uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Between 1893 World Parliament of Religions and the World's Fair in Chicago, and 1921 in the Burial of the Unknown Soldier.
That's terrific.
There's a lot of public events, very, very public events. Jamestown World's Fair in 1907.
Uh-huh.
I just went to the Jamestown 400th anniversary celebration, and so I could sort of experience that,
That's
as part of this. But I want to look at the way in which religion makes it into the public sphere,
mm-hmm.
and into the public conversations, mm-hmm. but then I want to look at to see if those public events reshape religion,
mm-hmm.
and what the congregations and denominations are doing.
It sounds like a really terrific project, and I wish you the best of luck on it.
Well, thank you. It's my sabbatical project, so
yeah,
I'm looking forward
right.
to it.
Yeah, those sabbaticals, they go by fast.
That's
well,
right.
J.D. Bowers, we've taken up enough of your time. We really, really appreciate
having
you,
Marshall.
On the show. It's been great. We will talk to you soon, okay?
Okay, thank you so much.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to an interview with J.D. Bowers, the author of Joseph Priestley and English Unitarianism in America. My name's Marshall Poe. I'm the host of New Books in History, and we'll see you next week.